Waking up on the right is a pine warbler now. Top of the pine trees here. And he's cycling through his songs nicely. The microphone's not picking up loudly. We could aim a parabolic microphone right at him and have him bursting into our ears, and we'll try to do that later. So let's just listen to who's joined the chorus now. Well, it's the veery straight out ahead of us, the pine warbler to the right. The hermit thrush for now is a little quiet. There was a wood thrush off to the left. The chickadee's not really launched into his dawn chorus of singing. I think what these birds do at dawn is best illustrated by a bird we could hear back on the road, but not right here. It's one of the most common birds in suburban areas, a chipping sparrow. And during the daytime, you find them in, you might call them a territory. You think of it as a territory. These birds are singing. As I uttered the word chipping sparrow, did one start singing behind us? I think it did. They sound so much like a pine warbler, it's a little difficult to know the difference. So chipping sparrows, during the daytime, you find them on what you might think of as their territories, each male and female on their own territory, but at dawn, all that breaks down. You can have a cluster of three or four males all in a little arena, sitting on, the pavement next to you. You're standing on a road through a cemetery, for example. Chipping sparrows seem to love cemeteries. And all these males are in this little cluster, this little arena, displaying as if, it looks very much, sounds very much like what we think of as a lek of where birds of species like birds of paradise and prairie chickens, where the males all gather together and the females come and make their mating decisions, mate with a male, and then leave to raise the young on their own. It's just that in chipping sparrows, things are a little different. The males are all together and fussing, and we don't know where the females are. But all this fussing among the males certainly looks like a lot of posturing, and a lot of information has to be there to an attentive listener. And if the female's going to make any decisions about who's going to be the father of her offspring, why, this little male-male contest arena would certainly seem like the situation where she would get her information. Some have thought for years that it's the number of songs a male can sing that impresses a female, and the more he has, the better off he is. But it doesn't make any sense for a whole bunch of reasons, and I could list the reasons why that doesn't work. Like this chickadee, he has one song. And when they're young birds, they practice more than one and then finally settle on one. If he kept just two songs instead of one, he'd be a rock star with the females, and there'd be an escalation of repertoire size, and so, it just doesn't work. But they've got to be listening to something, and there's some evidence that maybe it's how consistently a male can produce a song. Like, I'm told that if you're trying out for an opera position, the judges have all the contestants sing exactly the same piece so that they can compare how well they do on that same piece. And maybe the female birds are the same way, to say, all right, see how consistently you can sing this particular song. And a lot of the songs that the males seem to sing for females vary a lot less over geographic space. It's like the males all have a pretty set idea of what they need to sing. Back to her, though. My female human friends who feel sad that the female isn't singing, you have to think of her as the silent composer of everything that the male does. Because if the male doesn't do what she wants him to do, even though she's silent, he's not going to father any offspring. And so whatever he's doing that he thinks is pretty studly is not going to be passed on to the next generation. So she's making the choices as to who the successful singers are, and as a result, really, I love the image of her as a silent composer. She's sitting there listening and making decisions that affect how that veery is singing, how those pine warblers are singing right now, and the chipping sparrows on the pavement, on the gravel road behind us.
So that over time, if you were to listen to birdsong centuries ago, same birds, same species, would that, there's an evolution in birdsong then. If the female is kind of weeding out and composing, and it's changing over time.
Song does change over time. And we can think in terms of two evolutionary scales, really. One is cultural. It can change from one year to the next. And you can plot how song, you can, indigo buntings, for example, beautiful studies in Michigan showing Bob Payne and Laura Payne, they would go out to their study areas and they record all the birds. And you find little clusters of birds all singing the same little, in the little dialect. And you chart this over time, and this particular dialect fades out and a new dialect comes in. So it's a bit faddish as to what birds are doing in a particular year. And so you can think of that as, well, this is culture. It's a learned trait passed on from one generation to the next. And then certainly over evolutionary time, as we think about millions of years, there are changes that accumulate, genetic changes that accumulate, not just cultural changes, genetic changes. And you can think of a bird like the Baltimore Oriole, whose closest relative might be the Bolox Oriole out west, and how different their songs are. And a lot of the difference is genetic that has arisen over the few million years that they've been separated by the Great Plains.